Alright, so what do you think of this microphone, Toby?
It's just like a little baby, adorable Death Star.
I know, it is. That's what I've thought too. It's like a cute Death Star.
So, the thing that I'm really excited about doing today, which we would have done last week, and everyone would have listened to it, it would have probably melted the internet, is have a Halloween episode.
Yeah, I mean, this can still be a Halloween episode.
It's true. It might just singe the internet lightly, but yeah. The idea being, we'll each talk, I think, about two fears we have in academia. The other thing I'm excited about maybe instituting is I like the idea, and we've already been doing this a little bit. I was listening to the Ferrante episode the other day.
Uh-huh.
At the end, the last thing we do in the podcast is we have, like, a thesis moment.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, where we sort of, we bring it all back home.
Yeah, it'll be like the dismount off of the, you know, parallel bars. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, this is good. Yeah, I think this is great. All right, so, like, cue spooky Halloween music. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is
The Office Hour.
So, since this was your idea, Toby, I think we should start with you. So what is the thing about academia that scares you the most?
Oh, I have two, and I wasn't sure whether to kind of start more horrific and then go more existential, but I'll start with Northrop Frye.
Okay.
So Northrop Frye, super clever scholar back in the day.
Yeah.
Writes with beautiful humor and clarity, comes up with this system to think about all of literature generically, uses the seasons to delineate the different kind of patterns in literature, and within a couple years is laughably outdated. And anyone who uses Northrop Frye's seasonal model of literature looks like they're doing witchcraft or something. So I worry that the work that I do will not only be relatively meaningless in the near or very near future, but also be like laughably sort of
like cringeworthy.
Like
how did this guy think that this was a thing that was worth, like, not only you know, writing a book about, but spending, you know, dedicating years of work and research
and to. This was like a top scholar. And this book I read a couple years ago by Paul Fussell called The Great War in Modern Memory, which is maybe in some ways like the best literary book on World War One, and he uses Northrop Frye's seasonal system, and in the foreword to like the second or third edition, he's like, I really thought this was going to stick around.
Wait, so tell me, all I really know, I don't know very much about Northrop Frye, though, and if I can find it, I'll make this the image for this week's podcast. I went to a conference once at the University of Toronto where they have a building named after Northrop Frye, and there's like a statue of Northrop Frye.
Oh yeah, that's where he was a professor.
Yeah. So there's like a statue of him sitting on a bench, like, I think smoking a pipe. That might be an invention of my memory. But anyway, there is somewhere a picture of me, like, embracing the statue of Northrop Frye.
That's beautiful.
Wait, so this is, like, he had this theory of, like spring literature, like, summer literature.
Yeah, like, winter is irony. And
oh, God.
And part of it, it's really interesting because it grows out of the same ground as deconstructionism in a way.
Yeah.
He begins The Anatomy of Criticism, which is his great book, by saying, even if we were to stop producing literature today, we would never run out of content for critical engagement.
Right.
Because this is infinitely productive and infinitely intelligible. But how do we create an arbitrary system for tackling this infinity of powerful poetic information? And he says, there is no scientific system to this that is going to rigorously kind of allow us to index these things. So instead, let's take a system that makes some sense intuitively, is very graspable, and allows us to separate this information in ways where we can engage with it critically. And he comes up with the seasons.
Wow. That's really horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, but this, as a fear, though, I feel like this is, like, easy to avoid. Like, just don't try to create a master narrative. I feel like if you avoid trying to create a master narrative, like, a thing like that, which I haven't read it, but seems to try to explain everything.
Yeah,
in a sort of like tidy,
but that was like
fashion.
What people were into. I mean, what if our research in years to come looks like just like groveling, worm, pedantic, pathetic work? And in the future university, it's like only work that helps the critical algorithms that program our robot overlords is meaningful.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. Like the thing that drives me crazy is the use of like parentheses and titles.
Yeah. What if, like, in the future, titles with semicolons look stupid? Tell me one of your fears.
Okay, my fear is that the sort of cultural devaluation of academics is only going to continue apace, and, like, that in terms of my livelihood, even if I am successful enough to, like, get a job teaching college, and, like, that's what I do forever, that it will continue to be devalued and the adjunct crisis will only become more and more extreme. And, like, it gets to the point where, like, I didn't even need to get a PhD to teach college because, like, teaching college is, like, on par with, like, working at Taco Bell, which would be cool because I actually love Taco Bell and I would get free food. But, like, you know, or perhaps the fight for minimum wage will somehow, that will succeed, and maybe working at Taco Bell might even be, like, more, might have more of a financial incentive than teaching college. So, I mean, that's my primary fear.
Yeah, as we're saying, my second fear was adjunctification, and I think this is, in some ways, the boogeyman that exists in all of right-minded academia at the moment, is a sort of horror at what exactly is happening with the adjunct crisis, where I think it's something like 75% of classes nationally are now taught by contingent labor.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. I mean, we could fact-check that, but that sounds right.
That's a good number.
Yeah.
It's got a percent.
It's a good round number. Yeah.
And this is horrifying for a lot of reasons, not just necessarily personally, because I have three children and,
right,
you know, I want to have a job that is both, you know, intellectually rewarding and also allows me to live some version of the American dream, or at least make me feel somewhat in control and independent. But also because it strikes me that this changes just the nature of the university. And this isn't new as a fear, but I almost feel like how banal this form of institutional evil is now is almost more horrifying to me than the thing itself.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. That like we've just all sort of like tacitly accepted that this is how it is.
Yeah. Like imagine, I think about this whenever I'm driving and like way above the speed limit on 85 with everyone else driving way above the speed limit, and we
right.
pass a police car and I'm like, he could take any of us. He's just a lion watching zebras. And we don't care. Where it's like, you can pull us over. I'm going 25 over.
So, like, teaching this class about the presidential election, which I think we're going to talk about next week.
Are we?
Or the week after that. Ooh, I don't know.
Is Jennifer coming?
Jennifer is going to come.
I mean, Dr.
Dr. Jennifer Forsthoffel is going to come. But, like, this is the question, right? Which is more horrifying? The fact that, like, this whole Donald Trump thing has happened, or the fact that, like, there are surely people next Tuesday who are, like, just not going to vote because they don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
Like, is it more horrifying that the adjunctification of higher education has happened, or that, like, we're all just sort of, like, humdrum about it? That it's kind of, like, it's kind of a boring thing to complain about now.
Yeah. I don't know if you should come with me on this tangent, but no trick-or-treaters came to our apartment yesterday. Zero.
None.
And that's not to say there weren't we went trick-or-treating in a neighborhood
right.
that like had sidewalks and everything and blah, blah, blah. But it strikes me that there are places that are basically just cultural and meaningful wastelands at this point. And
oh,
people
yeah.
live there and nobody cares. Not even enough to stop by to get free candy, that like there's a certain kind of banality And I think, I mean, not to go totally deep end on this, but like Aleppo would be the other version of this, where people are just like,
what?
That's
that?
Yeah. Yeah. Holy <What's>... crap. Yeah. Yeah. That a presidential candidate could say that. That people are like, yeah, that's happening. Okay.
Right.
And just accept that that's happening in the world. It's not a lack of awareness. It's like utter acceptance of this thing. And I feel
radical
like...
radical acceptance.
Yeah. And that like adjuncting is kind of at that point that it's happening. People know it's both inside and outside. The like academia know it's happening on a massive scale. And people are kind of like, well, what are you going to do?
Right. It's not, you know... it's not a particularly pressing concern for a lot of people that individuals who are much more highly educated than them are not able to, like, make a decent living.
Yeah, and I feel like part of it is just this, like, total loss or maybe at least sharp decline in sort of communal empathy. And I think it doesn't help that people have to be mobile so often, right? Like, when I was growing up, we were in a neighborhood... and the kids lived in the neighborhood. The kids knew the houses that had kids. The kids presumably knew the houses that had candy. They walked around. They got the candy. They went back to their homes. If you're always jumping apartments, it's like nobody even knows if there are kids in those apartments. Or, like, living beings.
So this is, like, this brings me to my second fear. And I know it's your turn, but whatever. I'm just going to go for it. Which is that, okay, so I've been reading all of this stuff about particularly this George Packer article in The New Yorker about sort of how the Democratic Party has lost the white working class vote, which it used to sort of, that was its most dependable demographic for a very long time. But I've been thinking about how the fact that, like, we are, like, we both have PhDs, you and I, we have PhDs. Like, we're far more educated than, like, most people in the world, right? And there is a large demographic of people in America who are predisposed to, like, hate us, right? Like, we are bastions of the liberal elite. We don't understand them.
Yeah,
we don't care about them.
Make podcasts about Northrop Frye.
Right, we make a podcast about Northrop Frye on this, like, fancy microphone. Like, what if they're right? This is my fear. What if we had a guest speaker today, and me and Dr. Forsthoffel's class, Dr. Forsthoffel's and my class, Professor Mary Stuckey, who is a professor of communication and political science at Georgia State, and she was talking about in the Q&A afterwards, one of the students asked a question about sort of like mathematical analyses of political rhetoric. And one of the things that she mentioned is that there have been computative analyses of scholarship on political rhetoric, that do things like sort of count and sort words and stuff like that. I forgot the name of the program that she was talking about. It's on the tip of my tongue, but whatever. But so what they found is that even actually very, very high level academic scholarship on this stuff is more often than not ideologically biased. Like, what if despite our claims to truth and to knowledge and to wisdom and all of that stuff that we are, committed to as humanists and academics, what if we are actually just using our educations to forward a certain kind of worldview that is not, in fact, rooted in our education at all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I agree with that profoundly. And this speaks a little bit to... and I don't want to lose that. I feel like we should add a sound effect there. to kind of hail what a beautiful monologue
that
was.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or, like, what if...
or, like, just cheering. Slow clap or, like, a crescendo cheer.
Yeah, I'll do something like that. It'll be fun to, like, add that to my own thing that I said. what if what we are doing is actually not using our education to sort of encourage students to go pursue the truth, but actually we're just, like, forwarding a certain ideology? That might be a consequence of our education, but not explicitly because of the sort of expertise that we have developed as scholars or whatever.
Yeah, my uncanny fear of this comes from going to various academic conferences and feeling like different disciplines, even within English or literature or whatever, seem to have certain types of people. And you're like, well, what if part of that is not just, let's say I'm a Victorianist, that a certain kind of person is attracted towards Victorian novels, but then that those Victorian novels themselves do their ideological work on those readers to the point where you, a professor, trying to teach people to be critical of this text, are actually in some ways simply replicating and disseminating, like, Dickensian ideology in a way.
Oh, absolutely.
Because these are extremely persuasive texts. We spend our whole career talking about how powerful and persuasive these texts are. How affected are we by these things that we're reading? And especially if you're doing something like the great man version of history, Western literature. I studied Dickens and H.G. Wells and this kind of thing. How much are you just, like, a vehicle of that ideology rather than what you'd hope to be, I imagine, as, like, offering a critical perspective on that very material?
Right, exactly. Like, it is our job to be critics of this stuff. And yet the stuff that we often choose to be critical of is stuff that we like.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, do you enjoy reading Dickens novels?
I do.
Yeah, see?
That's my dirty secret. Peter Brooks has a great book on this called Reading for the Plot, which is all about melodrama and desire and this kind of, like, how what novels do is they co-opt our sort of sex drive and death drive to make us want the end of the novel.
That's compelling.
And you have, at some level, and once again, this is another version of a guy in a foreword who was like, I really thought this Freudian stuff would work better, but seems to have fallen by the wayside, and I feel kind of awful that my book depends on it. Despite the fact that he's still very invested in desire as the basic thing that fuels our interaction with art. And that seems to be something, and this is the other version of this thing, right? Like, if Northrop Frye was thinking, well, like, a seasonal allegory can allow us to engage with, like, an infinite...
seasonal allergy.
Yeah, a seasonal allergy can help us engage with a vast quantity of literature. What if in the future, scholars are like, did these idiots really leave desire and emotion out of their studies of, like, the politics and hermeneutics of these texts?
Oh, yeah. I once had an idea for a paper about, like, how having to go pee, like, affects your engagement with literature.
That's great.
Okay, are there any other fears you have?
No, those are the only fears in my
life. Yeah, those are the only fears I have. Given that, what do you think was the scariest thing we talked about today? Since this is a post-Halloween special.
I think the scariest thing we talked about, I'd have to say, is the sort of banality of evil, just passive acceptance of a system that is so profoundly exploitative, and our continued participation in that system, regardless of our knowledge about
it. Are we going to be people with PhDs who work at Taco Bell?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lnc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening!